Agenda item number seven. We're very lucky today to have a presentation on the Russian River Independent Science Review Panel Conceptual Model, the Russian River Hydrology, Surface Water and Groundwater Interactions, and Stream Ecology for the Russian River Watershed with Dr. Matt Kondoff and Laurel Marcus. I don't know if we had a staff introduction to this, but...
Well, I will just make brief remarks to say... first of all, our gratitude for Dr. Kondoff, who's a fellow Matthias, another Matthias, and Laurel Marcus of the California Land Stewardship Institute, to present to us today. This is a really kind of monumental report that they've put together. While water quality wasn't specifically one of the main factors that they looked at, it's focusing on hydrology, groundwater, surface water interaction. As you know from the strategic planning work that we did in identifying the critical role of that linkage between flow and water quality, that's a topic that the regional board is taking on. And so this report will kind of lay the foundation for how the Russian River watershed is managed holistically from a water resource management perspective. So with that, turn it over to, I think Laurel is going to start. Is that right? Okay.
Okay, fantastic. While they get queued up, I would just ask anybody that wants to speak on this item, feel free to fill out a speaker's card and get it to Ms. Patty, and we'll get you in queue. We'd love to hear what you have to say.
Great.
Good morning.
Take a seat here, and Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about our work. Appreciate the invitation, and thanks for all the interest. Laurel and I have been trying to make this happen for I don't know how many years, what I'll report on is work that we've actually undertaken over the past few years, and I'll give some of the details. But it was really recognizing the complexity of the Russian River system and the potential advantage in having a group with experience in some in the basin, but much in other places as well, take a look at the available information and kind of make an assessment on some of the important issues. So this was the ISRP, the Independent Science Review Panel. So we tried to assemble and review the existing data for the entire watershed, look at major data gaps, look at some of the monitoring methods out there currently, and probably most importantly, to formulate a conceptual model of the physical processes in the system, the hydrologic interactions, and the ecological implications of those. Right in the question, how do surface and groundwater interact to produce stream flow in creek and river channels, and how does this interaction vary spatially within the basin, especially in the fish-bearing tributary streams? So we prepared a report, and I brought it along. Let me... Anyway, if anyone's interested, you're welcome to have a look at that. like I say, it's complicated. We try to boil down some key points here as well. So we looked at the entire catchment as a whole, you know, sort of systematically, but we focused in on certain areas with more detail. So we looked at land use changes, some of the historical changes in land use and water use. As Matt mentioned, we didn't really focus on water quality per se, although stream temperature was an important factor we considered. So we assumed existing water infrastructure and operations and current land use, talked about how things have changed, but we didn't discuss, you know, policies and regulation of land use particularly. Fish species, of course, important. We touched on some other wildlife, but not really that much. And we're pretty much using data up through 2015. So to develop to put the panel together, we had funding, this is going back in 2012, the Sonoma County Water Agency, Mendocino County Flood Control and Water Conservation District, agricultural groups, and watershed organizations in the two counties. And then when we had enough funding to get going, we put out a request for people to nominate others or nominate themselves. And we had 16 applications. And we put together a panel to review these, people from the two water agencies, the Conservation Council, NIMFs, representatives from the ag communities, and we reviewed. And we had all the applicants submit a conflict of interest form, which is the same form that the National Research Council uses for their and NSF, National Science Foundation, uses for their grants and things. So anyway, this is the panel that we wound up with. It's very strong in hydrologists, groundwater people, but also ecologists. And for example, Doug Shields is the last one mentioned. He's a colleague I've worked with quite a bit from Mississippi. He used to be with the Corps and with the Agricultural Research Service. But he brought a very a great fresh perspective to the basin from his experience around the world. And then for the report, after we had put it together, we had a team of peer reviewers, again, very well-qualified people to provide peer reviews, and then we went through a process of responding to all those comments. So then to briefly go through some of the results and the concepts, it's useful to bear in mind that the Russian River watershed, it's, you know, one of the larger ones along the coast, 1 million acres, but it's quite distinctive in its series of alluvial river valleys. I mean, you have some of this, like on the Eel and so on, but it's very distinctive on the Russian, that you have the Redwood, Ukiah, Hopland, Alexander, and Russian River valleys. And you have mountains bordering these, and then these specific alluvial valleys, kind of pearls on a chain, you know. And these alluvial valleys are formed by the differential movements along the parallel faults. So they're called pull-apart basins, and essentially this movement along the faults opens up a gap in which sediment can accumulate, and that sand and gravel then has the capacity to store water. And so that's really what we're seeing, the sort of the geologic framework of these valleys. And the valleys are so important because they are where you have the alluvium, and that's the potential to store the water. In terms of the rocks that surround the valleys, a lot of it's Franciscan complex, which is very erodible material, so it's produced a lot of gravel and other sediment over time, but it has very low permeability in general, relatively little water yield if you try to sink a well in that. There's also Sonoma volcanics, which were produced in the last 8 to 2.5 million years ago, and some of these wells in that formation can be productive. So overall, we have about 42 inches of rain. Tends to be higher in the mountains on the west, of course. Varies a lot with the topography. Down in the southern portions, we might only have 22 inches of rain. And most of the streams continue to flow all year. And that's obviously not from direct rain. It's from draining of groundwater from the hills primarily. The river channels changed a lot in the last 100, 150 years. This is a view from the early 20th century of Perkins Street Bridge in Ukiah Valley. And what you can see is that it was a broad river channel, lots of gravel, and the river channel was virtually at the same level as the surrounding floodplain. It was not what we see today, a deeply incised channel. So it's a very different condition. And this means that you had a relatively shallow water table across the floodplain, which ecologically could support, more interesting riparian vegetation. But also there was a very strong connection with groundwater. and we'll get back to this, but one of the key things about this is that strong groundwater connection meant that even during the dry season, you were always getting exchanges with groundwater. So if you were to walk into a pool in the Russian River at that time, the pool would basically be the groundwater, and that was cool water, and it was great for fish habitat. Just looking at this whole Russian River Valley, all these valleys, all these alluvial valleys are formed by alluvium or sediment carried by the river and built up over time. And you can see the reflection of the old channel patterns in here, but just think about the whole sequence of sediments in these alluvial valleys was brought in by the river and the tributaries over time. So the river naturally had very high seasonal variability. And this is a view of the you can see the channel in the background and some agriculture in the foreground, but some of the early reports described it as a completely dry channel in some places, you might have occasional pools with water, but the river itself could dry up in dry years. This is probably just above Healdsburg here. You get a sense of the size of that gravel bar. You see where we've marked swimmers. Those dots are little people. And you get an idea if you look up to the left, that is a gravel bar that was there. There was a lot of gravel in the system at that time. So we have some data from different sources just compiled here to give an idea of how low the flows were at different parts of the river during the dry season, as documented at different points and for different reasons. But again, there would be a very high seasonal variability. You get very big floods in certain winters, and then dry years in August and September, it could go very, very low. Now, of course, that changed with the addition of water from the Potter Valley Project. I won't belabor that point. I think everyone here knows that story pretty well. But those releases have really changed the summer hydrology. The base flow has been tremendously elevated because of that water from Potter Valley from the Eel River. And then other big changes, gravel mining in the river has caused dramatic changes. This is in the Russian River Valley, what we used to call the Middle Reach. This was an Army Corps of Engineers project to correct the river, straighten the river, and better drain the agricultural land, and also to provide the opportunity to mine the gravel in these meander bends that were now cut off, and they're just sitting there in a great place to mine gravel. So this was a huge impact on the river system. And when you dig a pit in the river, you are obviously lowering the river at that point, but you are also triggering a response in the river that the river will tend to even out. From that one point where you've dug the pit, you will get, this is an oversteepened part, that will concentrate erosion, so that will migrate upstream. That's what we call head cut migration or regressive erosion. And then the downstream part, it also erodes, and that's because you have trapped the sediment in the river. So naturally you have a flow of sediment coming through. Here it's continuous. Here it gets trapped in here so that you don't have the sediment down here. You still have the power to move the sediment, but you don't have the sediment load. So you get erosion down here by hungry water. So a gravel pit in the river tends to produce incision up and downstream. As the channel incises, the banks destabilize and start to collapse. And back in the 50s and 60s, USDA was recommending farmers to use car bodies to stabilize their stream banks. So, obviously a lot has changed in the way we view the rivers, but we've inherited a lot of this, impacts from past activities, and not just the activities themselves like gravel mining, but the fixes that were recommended at that time. Just to give you a sense of the scale, these are some Army Corps of Engineers plans for, quote, improving the Russian River channel. This is for the Ukiah Valley, and when we color it in, you can see a little bit better how much it's changed. Just the scale was massive, over 200,000 cubic yards of material excavated to make this channel, 10 miles of jack lines, lots of willow plantings, lots of channel clearing. Similar in the Alexander Valley, the same idea, you take this meandering channel and straighten it out, correct the river, and these are some of the jack lines that were done. Here, some of them are in place, and you know, when the river channel shifts away from the jack line, you wind up with this wonderful feature, which we could probably build a Hollywood movie around that thing. So we have the incision from the gravel mining, but there's also incision from the dams, because the dams are trapping the sediment and creating what we call this hungry water downstream. And to understand this, you have to really think about the system, and it's not just water falling on the whole watershed and working its way down into the channel and then down the river. It's also sediment. Sediment is moving in the same way with the water. And, we have, back when the Clean Water Act was passed in the 70s, we would think of sediment more as a pollutant, but sediment is also a central part of the river. It creates the architecture of the river. It's what the river channel is made of. And of course, it's what also stores the groundwater down below. So it's an essential part of the river system, and you think of the natural river system has this continuity of transport from the eroding areas and the uplands down to some depositional area, you know, in the downstream. It's like a conveyor belt, and if you interrupt that natural continuity of sediment transport, you have consequences. So if you build in a dam, you still have the river carrying sediment downstream, only its supply has been cut off. So below dams, you tend to see this dramatic incision. As the channel cuts down, that then induces incision propagating up the tributaries as well. So then you've got the dam, and it is releasing water in an unnatural pattern. So you've got the dam. This is an example from the 1996 flood, where you've got the releases from the reservoir, which the reservoir is storing some water, but they're a pretty natural looking pattern. But then what's this? This is the reservoir releasing, doing its flood control release. It sounds counterintuitive, but we see this in a lot of places. Like, I've worked on Stony Creek, tributary of the Sacramento, and this has been documented in other rivers. If you have this, the management of the rivers, of the reservoirs for flood control, can actually increase erosion downstream. Because if you just let the natural flood go, it's going to spread out over the floodplain. It'll get slowed down going through forests and other things. It dissipates a lot of energy. But if you just release a steady flow that stays within the channel, right up to the channel banks, that's all efficiently eroding the banks. So anyway, we have changed the pattern, and that has potentially increased some of the erosivity. Then as you incise the main channel, that lowers the groundwater table adjacent to the stream. And this has been well documented in many rivers around the world. It's not a local Russian River thing. This is just the Russian River following the laws of physics that we see in many other places. But it has a lot of consequences. It has consequences for the storage of water in the alluvium that people might be counting on. It has ecological consequences. Just to remind you that this is a worldwide thing. This is one book on this topic, with the various chapters in there discussing the issues in kind of topically and from place to place. This is came out in 1999, so it's not a new kind of problem, but it's definitely what we see on the Russian River. And then we think about how do the tributaries interact with this channel that has now cut down, 20 feet in some places, and that the channel is acting like a French drain. It's draining the water from the sand and gravel in the banks down to that new level of this, it's like a ditch. And where you have a tributary coming in, then that affects the tributary, and that can cause the tributary to go dry. We don't have that many examples of this where we've studied this in the Russian River, but Laurel was involved in a study in which they looked at Morrison Creek. So in the river, you had this kind of pattern. In Morrison Creek, the groundwater in the wells near Morrison Creek went up, and then as the river level dropped, the water in the wells in Morrison Creek dropped. And that's the key thing. And when you look at Morrison Creek, when the river's high and Morrison Creek is high, when Riverside, Morrison Creek aside, Morrison Creek is flowing into the river. There's surface water connectivity. But then when the river stage drops, even if Morrison Creek is still flowing, Morrison Creek will sink into the gravel, and it won't make it to the river. So it's not necessarily that someone has reduced the flow in Morrison Creek. It's just that the bottom has dropped out of the water table so that Morrison Creek dries out. So you can have a situation like this where there's, you know, you still have a good flow in the creek, but it's going to sink into that gravel and it won't make it to the river. It'll make it subsurface, but that's not helping the fish. The fish won't be able to, work their way through the gravel. They need water on the surface. And so this is a problem that we can see. When the flows in the river are high, then you do get the connected flow. And one of the things we did in the report was to look. Morrison Creek is one type of stream and its connection with the river, but there are other types. There are some streams that have a bedrock sill in between that kind of isolate them from the fluctuations in the river. So we tried to articulate some of those different typologies along the river. That was the master's thesis work of my student, Scott Walls. So this is very important for the fish because coho and steelhead rear in the tributaries in the summer. They depend on cold water pools in order to do this. And some creeks naturally dry up in the summer. Some maintain their flow, but many of them have been affected by the fact that the river is in size, so the lower part have these impacts. And of course, there are other impacts to the tributaries as well. You know, some have been channelized, like this is Dooley Creek up here. Oh my, Dooley Creek that used to have quite a complex form, and that was dramatically simplified. We have had some urbanization in some parts of the basin. A lot of little pond, water storage features have been built that alters the flow and changes the connectivity. So I'm not going to go through all these, but there are many efforts to restore the system. And I don't think I have time to really go through this, but I want to acknowledge those and maybe make the pitch that we really need to think about our individual restoration efforts in this big picture of the processes, how the groundwater is recharged, how it interacts with the streams and the river. We've had groundwater studies completed by the U.S. Geological Survey in three of the big alluvial valleys, Ukiah, Alexander Valley, and Santa Rosa Plain. But these studies were undertaken long after the main incision had occurred. So the patterns that you see don't show us the impact of the NAM. It just sort of shows us, the current situation now. And again, when you think about how this works, you've got the uplands areas, water infiltrates. Some of it runs off on the surface, but a lot of it is going subsurface. And then you have these big alluvial valleys, and that's really where the water is stored, and it's stored in a form that you can easily pump it out. It flows rapidly to a well, so this is a great place to have, to use the groundwater resources. But you are depending on the recharge from the slopes and the recharge from the river. So the river flowing through, when it's at high stage, it does something called bank recharge, where it flows into the banks. So that's another way that this alluvial aquifer is recharged, and it flows directly into the bed as well. And when I talked about those observations from around 1900 where the river was drying up, that would be the case where you had water coming in probably from bedrock tributaries, it flowed in the river, and then it was sinking into the gravel so that as you went downstream at some point, it just dried up. So we need to think about the whole system and bear in mind the importance of the storage of water in the aquifer. And here's an example. This is the Ukiah Valley, the major groundwater basins. And this is true throughout the whole state. We see this with Sigma. We're looking at where the groundwater bases. They're pretty much all alluvial valleys. And certainly the case with the Russian. So we look at this. Here's a diagram of the Ukiah Valley. This is where the water storage is, we have some recharge coming in from up here, some of the recharge from the river itself, but that's where the storage is. And so these studies by the USGS. They have taken data from these different well logs, so you can see from the well logs you have data on how deep are the gravel formations, and then you kind of tie all these bits together to try to get a three-dimensional view. But again, we don't have some X-ray vision where we can see what it is throughout the whole thing. It's always interpolated from the available data. And then, these are, again, quite recent data post-incision, but we can see the patterns, the very strong seasonal patterns, you know, from the wet season measurements to the dry season measurements. There's quite a bit of fluctuation in these wells, but we haven't seen any long-term change, really. And again, these data are since the incision of the river. We don't really have any comparable data prior to the incision. So I think this is not really a kind of thing that I just want to show you that these data exist in the report, talking about the different groundwater basins, what they're made of, a little more about the Alexander Valley, similar kinds of patterns, and again, the monitoring data that are out there, and summarizing some of that. And then Santa Rosa Plains, a little bit different, it's a little broader, but and there's some possible over-extraction of a deep aquifer, but again, it relies on the same kind of recharge patterns as we've seen in the others. So just summarizing the groundwater part of this, it's very complex because of the geological setting. And we have, looking at the extraction of water and the recharge, there's some imbalance maybe in the two in Sonoma County. The ones, the Redwood, Ukiah, and Hopland appear to be pretty much in balance. But the key thing is this is not fossil water. We're not talking about the Ogallala Aquifer in the Great Plains, you know, where that's millions of year old water that's being mined. This system is recharged, you know, in wet years. And so it's more of a balance. You know, your checking account money comes in from your paycheck and it goes out to other things, and we can try to account for it that way. But the one key thing is that groundwater is a primary source of water for the summer rearing of the fish, understanding the importance, historical importance of the groundwater in maintaining cool water for the fish. That's one thing that we try to emphasize in the report, and I think Laura will talk a bit more about that. But 25 CFS of water in the Russian River in 1900 was very different than a 25 CFS that we might release from the dam today, in terms of temperature and water quality. So that's I think another key message from our report. So with that, I will turn it over to Laurel.
May I ask board members before you sign off here for a minute? Do you want to take questions now? You want to just see the whole thing through? What's the pleasure of the board?
Let's see it through.
Let's see it through, Ms. Laura Marcus.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to try to summarize the rest of the report, which is very lengthy, and I'm going to leave a lot of things out. But you can actually download a digital copy if you really want to know something.
Don't break your computer.
Yeah, don't. Okay, so one of the biggest parts of this project was to come up with a conceptual model of these stream flow processes. And this was done by Dr. Kondolf and his graduate student, Scott Walls, as part of his master's thesis, and then reviewed by the ISRP and embellished with more information. So what they looked at, again, is this interaction between surface and groundwater, and they used primarily the thickness and type of alluvial deposit and the degree of natural channel confinement to define the type of interaction you'd have between surface and groundwater. By using those features, they identified 8 different channel types and then mapped those for all of the fish-bearing streams in the areas of the Russian River we looked at in great detail. I'm going to go through each of these in more detail. I will skip that. So this kind of shows a cross-section through the watershed and where you would find these different types of channels. And this would be a cross-section through one of the valley areas. So up at the very top, you're going to have colluvial and bedrock canyons. And as I'll show you in some examples, where there's a wider area for the creek, you get confined alluvial and semi-confined alluvial. Then where the creek meets the valley floor, there'll be an alluvial fan, typically, maybe some more other types of channels. And then as you get down onto the valley floor, you get alluvial unconfined channels and then the river. Now, for each one of these channel types, all of the streamflow gauging data for the watershed was collected so that we could look at the flow characteristics. So this is just one of the graphs that shows for three different creeks, Gill Creek, Sasol Creek, and Pena Creek, what kind of flows the alluvial fan portion of the channel had. And as would be expected, they're mostly intermittent. That's typical of an alluvial fan. By comparison, this is a bedrock canyon channel, and we have five different gauges that are looked at, and in most instances, you have perennial flow. So it gives you kind of the differences based on the geology. So we're going to look at the Knights Valley subarea. This would be the Myokama Creek watershed, and this is one of the maps that shows the different types of streams. So here's colluvial down to regulated river, and they're mapped by color. So we have lots of bedrock canyon up in the steeper areas. And then this yellow color is semi-confined alluvial. Confined alluvial is the blue. The red is dissected alluvium, which is kind of a unique channel type that I'll show you some pictures of. And then down here at the very bottom, we have the unconfined alluvial. So this is a colluvial channel. It's really a headwater stream. It's high slope. Very few colluvial channels support salmonids. They're usually very flashy, very little flow in the dry season or after much rain has happened. But they do make up most of the drainage network. So they're up in all the hills. And this is a typical bedrock channel. Again, it can go up to 8% slope. It's confined by canyon walls. It doesn't have a floodplain, very little alluvial deposit. Typically will have year-round flow. The bedrock's impermeable, so the water is not going to infiltrate. But the bedrock also provides water during the summer. So small cracks and fissures in things like Franciscan complex will allow water to move out of bedrock and into the stream. And something like Sonoma Volcanics get a lot more spring, so you get a lot more flow typically in those streams. Mark West Creek would be an example of a Sonoma Volcanics-dominated bedrock stream, whereas this is an upper part of Myokama Creek, and this has got both Sonoma Volcanics and Franciscan Complex. Now, this is a confined alluvial channel, and you can just see the alluvial deposit. So it's a slightly wider place in a bedrock stream where the water can slow down and deposit some alluvium. But typically, it's not a really deep deposit, so it's relatively thin. It's going to have slightly lower slope, and it still has the confining walls and not really a floodplain, but it will have gravel bars. And we believe that this can support salmonid spawning and winter rearing, but the fish may have to move up to the bedrock channel in the summer because we may not have enough flow. Now, the semi-confined alluvial channel is a slightly wider area, again, in kind of a bedrock channel complex, where one of the banks of the stream is a hill slope. So you can have floodplains under these channels, much larger, deeper deposits of alluvium. Again, relatively low slope, 1 to 4%. And these are likely places where this pull-apart geology is occurring. So they're sort of valleys of the future. They're going to get wider. And these, again, can support salmonid spawning and winter rearing, but the fish may have to move into the bedrock streams in the summer. Now, this is an alluvial fan channel. Clearly, that picture is not from here. But deserts are much easier to see this in because there's no vegetation. Alluvial fans have multiple channels, and they move a lot of bedrock, and they're conical in shape. And one of their distinctive features is that much of the water flow will infiltrate at the head of the fan and come out down at the base. These occur all over the Russian River. And many of our wetland complexes, things like Katahdi, that used to be a lake, occur because they're at the discharge end of the fan. And, of course, we've manipulated these greatly, tried to get them all into one channel. But when we have large winter rainy seasons, you'll find that they break out of that mold and they'll migrate and move rocks all over the place. These are not salmon rearing habitat. The report actually discusses evaluations of several restoration projects for rearing habitat in alluvial fans. And that fact was one of the reasons we wanted to do this study, is because we started to see things that were misplaced in the landscape. They can be a barrier if there's not sufficient flow for the adult fish to go up or the juvenile fish to come down. They can get stranded on the fans. And this is an example of the fan that's in Knights Valley. It's very big. Now, this is the dissected alluvium channel. Dissected alluvium kind of looks like a cliff from Utah or red rock type country. It's very old material that was deposited into the pull-apart basins during the first million years when they were filling. It's high in clay, and it gets consolidated and then uplifted by more recent tectonic activity. And these banks tend to be up to 50 feet tall. So they're very unusual. They only occur in a few locations. But they do seem to have pretty good summer flows in them. So this may be an important part of where the fish rear. Then the unconfined alluvial channels we all can see pretty well from roads in this area. This is the lower end of Myokama Creek. And this will have a small amount of flow typically in the summer, but it's usually too warm to have fish rear in it. Not really clear from looking at all the historic data whether the streams in these valleys ever really were big rearing areas for the fish. The panel went back and forth over whether we had enough information to really say that they were. There was a lot of records of dry channels, and because, of course, the water can easily infiltrate into the big alluvial deposits in these valleys. So it's not really clear. It's just like the main stem river is also not very well documented as supporting steelhead rearing. Maybe in very cold, wet years it might have, but then there are records of it drying out. So we don't really know the answer to this question. And then at the very bottom of the drainage, everything goes into the main stem of the river, which is regulated and has changed a great deal, as you already heard. Now, just to show you another example of this in Ukiah, a much shorter stream, Morrison Creek, we have, bedrock up in here, and the Myokama Fault is right in here. So this follows the Myokama Fault trace. And it looks like this, great conditions in the bedrock area. Then it comes out into an alluvial fan, and right here, you can see the water is sinking right into the ground. And, of course, the river channel is down at a low stage, so the slope between where the water comes out of the canyon onto the alluvium and the river, which is probably down over here on the floor, is very steep. So it means that the water infiltrates and moves underground. And then this is typically what it looks like most of the time. It's dry. And here you can see it going subterranean. And then you get out on the river, and you see these deltas. And there are several creeks that seem to provide a large delta into the river, because this section of the river is 30 feet deep and very ditch-like. So this is one of the biggest suppliers of gravel. Now, I'm not going to read this chart, but this is in the report. So you can look up each one of these different types of channels and find out all sorts of different things about it, whether it's affected by drought, how, whether it's affected by the main stem, its vulnerability to bank erosion and such. Now, the fish. So we have three species of fish. Chinook's on the main stem. Coho is in a select set of tributaries, mostly southern and western part of the basin. And then steelhead appears to be everywhere. So again, looking at these different types of channels up here, we took the different stages of the life cycle for the three species and noted which channel is most likely to provide for those habitat requirements. The black boxes mean that it will always supply it. The gray boxes mean that it could, depending on local conditions, and the white boxes mean that it doesn't supply that. So that when you are looking at restoration projects, you can look at these different channel types and understand better their function in terms of the salmonid life cycle and then restore features along those guidelines so that we don't see these mismatched restoration and channel functions as we've seen in a number of places. I think I'll go through these quicker. Okay. Now, I'm going to breeze through the recommendations really quickly. There's five basic ones. This map shows the green subbasins were the ones that we did all of the focus work in. We did not address individual streams in these other ones. And the panel felt that the entire drainage needed to be included and that we should continue working and finish up the brown subbasins as well. Then after reviewing all of the available data and identifying the major data gaps, the panel recommended a series of studies for the highest priority of data gaps because you can't study everything. They developed some economics incentives to change the way water is managed. And then four is a very important one. This is a conceptual model, which is the first step that you take. The second step that you take is to develop a numerical model based on the conceptual model. So they're recommending that probably a GS flow model be developed. And it's my understanding that that is occurring by the Sonoma County Water Agency working with the State Water Board and the USGS. So we're very pleased to see that. And then they put together some restoration recommendations for each channel type. So I'm going to very quickly go through the data gaps. Okay, we looked at information on all those topics and recommended additional data collection for aquatic communities, groundwater, surface water, water use, and then some very focused studies in geomorphology and climate change. Now, I think the aquatic communities might be the most important one. We were all a little alarmed to find that there is almost no comprehensive ecological data on the Russian River and its tributaries. The vast majority of studies are one-day qualitative habitat surveys of creeks, one-time collections of benthic macroinvertebrates or juvenile salmonids, and often the field data that went with these was not adequate to even determine the location of where they were sampled. The main stem river has had a great deal of study by comparison, mostly coming from the Sonoma County Water Agency. There's no population data and very limited presence-absent data on steelhead. So we don't really have much of a handle on what is a priority creek and what is not. For any fish that was not a salmonid or an amphibian or invertebrate, there was almost no data. And for the most part, species are being studied in isolation. This has some problems because when you're looking at how to conserve an anadromous fish population, you really have to look at the entire ecological picture, not just what is that one species doing. You have to know about its food supply, its predators, all these other things. We know almost nothing about those. So that was probably the biggest data gap we came across. You've already heard a bit about the groundwater ones where we really need more data, particularly continuous groundwater monitoring data. instead of the twice a year measurements that are done by the CASGEM program. Okay. Surface water, we have a lot of streamflow gauges on the main stem, but not very many in the tributaries. Although that has been changing with the frost regulation, we have been putting gauges into the tributaries. So we're moving on a little bit on that one. For our geomorphology, one of the biggest data gaps we found was that no one had really looked at the main stem channel, particularly in Mendocino County, in decades. There continues to be some surveying done in the Alexander Valley, but we don't really know how the incision process is continuing, whether it's ended, whether it's the river is still deepening, some of these basic questions. The climate change questions are big and broad. We know we're going to have much hotter temperatures. Well, what does that do to specific tributaries? And where are the fish going to be? So that when we're looking again at how to restore things, we should be making sure that we're doing these activities in tributaries where we're going to have cold water in the future. Now, I wanted to show you the water demand ones even in a little more detail because these are ones I think we have more control over because they're human activities. Municipal water use we know very well because people have meters and it's, you know, regulated. Groundwater use, we don't really know who's using groundwater where necessarily. There's no requirement to report it to anybody. There's no requirement to measure the amount of water extracted from wells for any type of use. And under the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, there will probably be some type of requirements at some point. Rural residential water use is a very big use, actually, in this, particularly Sonoma County. If you look at the second point, in the Santa Rosa Plain study, the USGS estimated rural non-municipal use of groundwater was 82% of total groundwater extraction, only 32% of that going to agriculture and a full 50% going to rural residential use. So it gives you an idea of kind of the size of the water use in this group. Agricultural water use for surface water has been pretty well defined. All those dots are little reservoirs. However, those are only for typically grapes or pears. They do not include marijuana water use, which is a sort of an underground use of water. Don't really have to read that. But we took all the water rights data that was reported and tried to figure out, well, how much water is actually being used in different places. And we found, again, that that wasn't really possible because if you see the line that says percent reported for each of these different years, it never really gets very close to 100%. The highest we get is 75%. So we can't really, again, use the reporting to come up with any totals. If we wanted to know what's the total amount of surface water use in the Myakama tributary basin. Now, we borrowed this map. This is a Fish and Wildlife map, and it's for Outlet Creek, which is just north of the Russian River. And we looked into how much water marijuana uses, and the only published number we could find is that it's about 7 to 15 times as much per plant as a grapevine. So much larger water demand. And we know, you know, from these maps of where these plants are being grown that most of this water is being extracted through illegal surface water or perhaps a well if there was an adequate amount of groundwater in some of these places. So one of the big concerns that the panel identified was getting a handle on how much water this particular crop is using and bringing it more into a regulated system. I think I'm going to zoom through this. We had a resource economist on the panel, which was really great. And one of his recommendations is that we start looking at water markets. And the reason for this is that it would allow in dry years people who have stored water to possibly provide that water to other buyers. There's very active water markets in other parts of California, And if we had one here, we might be able to provide water for the fish and for all the different uses in different years when we have shortages. So that was his recommendation. Okay, I already talked a bit about the numerical model. The thing I like about this slide is right here. For example, the significance of a dry channel or intermittent pools cannot be determined if we do not know what areas of tributary salmonids use for rearing. If the one reach of good rearing habitat dries up, this would be a significant problem. But if that reach is a migration corridor where water is only needed in the winter and spring, a summer dry channel is not a problem. Because we're in a Mediterranean climate, many streams dry up naturally. And we can't just make the assumption that if we changed all the water uses in the basin, we would have perennial flow all over the place. I have heard people say that in this drainage. The reality is that it's very complicated, and you really do have to look at each tributary basin and determine where the areas are that would have year-round flow versus those that don't. So the use of one of these very detailed models is the best way to get at that question. And this is just a map, a graph of the kind of outputs you get from the model. It looks at stream flow, loss to the stream bed, groundwater discharge to streams, and then net groundwater discharge to streams. So it kind of does a lot of the math, and it's a very good way to evaluate things. Okay, last part, not going to take too long. We also put together general restoration recommendations for each channel type and the overall system. So one of the biggest things that needs to be done is removal of fish migration barriers. Oftentimes, these are old in-stream reservoirs, culverts like this that the fish can't jump through. There's been a lot of progress made on this, but there's still quite a few more that need to be done. And there is a database. This is a map of that database that shows where a lot of these barriers are. Revegetation. There are often sections of streams where a good revegetation project would do an enormous amount for the wildlife along the stream. And, oh, that's unusual. Okay. This is supposed to show putting in wood in the stream, but it has like an extra picture on top of it. And we were, they were recommending against using a lot of artificial structures where you pile rocks up to try to manipulate the active channel and get more pools. That's kind of what this is like. These are little weirs in a very straight channel where the water is supposed to flow over the weir and make a pool. But in reality, most of the time, the water goes around the rocks and undoes a lot of the placement of rock in the channel. Gravel augmentation below dams. This would particularly be good below Coyote Dam. And that has happened a lot in other rivers in California, but not here. And then when you do have an incised stream, instead of trying to keep that incised condition, you have to widen it out and create a bench or a new floodplain. That's kind of another basic restoration step. For water management, they recommended more construction of off-stream ponds, putting fish screens on all diversions. And then in some cases, particularly in those like semi-confined alluvial systems, that you screen the well deeper. So instead of drawing from 10 feet below the ground, you draw from 50 feet below the ground, and you have less impact on the surface well. Now, I can kind of zoom through these, or we could end here. It depends on how much time you have.
Yeah, okay. we're doing okay. Well.
So colluvial streams, these are your headwater streams. The primary focus here is to keep water moving downstream, downslope, cool and clear. You want to keep them stable and vegetated. You want to avoid gully formation and different types of erosion. Bedrock perennial flow streams, these you want to protect. You want to change summer direct diversions to winter-only diversions with storage, and this would be for agriculture and rural residential. You want to remove migration barriers, install large wood, and, of course, keep it revegetated. for a confined alluvial stream where you may have 6 to 12 months of flow depending on the particular conditions, this is the kind of place where if you do have wells in this shallow alluvial deposit, you want to screen them deeper. Again, you want to convert summer direct diversions to winter only with storage, revegetate, remove migration barriers, and add large wood. Now here with the semi-confined alluvial, it becomes, because the deposit is thicker and covers more space, it becomes more complicated, and so you would want to be sure to use a numerical model to manage your wells and diversions so that you can really figure out if they're having an impact on flow or not. Revegetation, remove the barriers, increase the large wood, and in here is the type of place where you would set the banks back to avoid incision. And you may need to look at grade control if it's incised. Dissected alluvium. This picture, you can really see this really tall clay material banks. Very different sort of looking. Because it's complicated, we want to use the numerical model to manage water. And then again, all the same restoration recommendations as the semi-confined. Alluvial fan. This one we aren't recommending any of the typical riparian revegetation. If you look at the historic conditions of these, they're covered with oak savanna. They're not willow-lined streams. But because these can be major flow barriers for the salmonids, we want to kind of look at whether the changes in main stem river flow stage are having any effects on connected flow in these areas. And then we get to the unconfined alluvial channels, the ones in the valleys. Again, you have to use the model to get at this because you have all sorts of different water management. You do want to revegetate it, set the back the banks, make it more stable, but you can't necessarily assume that you're going to have spawning and rearing throughout these channels because most of them are dry in the summer and sometimes even between storms. Now, for the river itself, we talked about how much restoration you could do on the main Russian River for a long time. And the final recommendation is that just below Coyote Dam, where you have a cold water outlet, you have the potential to create salmonid habitat. We don't exactly know how far down from the dam that cold water remains cold. Because you don't have a closed canopy over the river, and it completely circulates the water, at some point downstream it will get too warm. But it could be 5 miles, 10 miles. That's kind of a study that needs to be done. We would want to widen the channel, create complex corridor, and of course work with willing landowners so that people cooperate and like this project. Also do gravel augmentation. The narrows, which is where one of the bedrock sections of the river are, is another possibility to improve for salmonids because it has colder water. The rest of the reaches of the Russian River are really too warm in the summer for steelhead now. They're well over 70 degrees. They're great for winter and spring spawning and rearing for Chinook, and there's quite a bit of information on that. But just because they don't support salmonids year-round doesn't mean that they aren't important for a lot of other animals. So improving the riparian and aquatic habitat for all the different birds, mammals, amphibians and native fish that live there is well worth the effort. And they are recommending that gravel mining in the river channel itself be minimized. And I think that might be it. Yes. Did I leave anything out? Okay. And with that, we can answer any questions if we haven't put you to sleep.
Well, first off, thank you very much. I was one of the people that downloaded that 600-page report. I've gotten a good ways through it. It's a very interesting and very well written report, and I think it's foundational in its the premise of putting together then a compendium of information about what was, what is, and what could be here. With that, I'll open it up to board member questions. Is there board member questions? Ms. Valerie Minton?
Thank you. Thanks so much for the report. I actually attended the public workshop up in Cloverdale, and this is dense enough that I just learned a lot more hearing it a second time. So thanks for that. Dr. Condolf, it really struck me when you talked about the main channel acting like a French drain and sort of dewatering tributaries. And I'm wondering if you have any sense of how high up into a tributary that effect travels. And it made me wonder if when we look at in-stream flow restoration in tributaries, if we're missing the boat, if we're not looking at trying to do something in the main channel to reverse that impact.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, or at least account for the effect of the main stem. I guess Morrison Creek would be kind of a poster child since it's one of the few places we actually have a study that was done. So that would be, I don't know, at least a mile up that probably that it's affected. Or
well,
to think how far
it's sort of a complicated set of circumstances. So if you have a year like this where the ground is saturated and it never really drains between storms, you can get pretty good continuous flow. It's more the years where you have a big rainstorm and then it dries out for a couple of weeks and then it might rain again. Those storms typically just simply don't get very far down the channel on Morrison and Parsons Creek both. They might get half to three quarters of the way from the canyon to the river, and then they just go underground. So there definitely needs to be more study on this, I think. We know this occurs up in the Mendocino section and to some degree in Alexander Valley, but there's a lot of different circumstances that affect it. So it definitely needs to be studied.
Yeah, and as you implied, just take it into account in any kind of in-stream flow. You can't just assume it's a pipe that will convey the water downstream. That's, I guess, the message. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Hales?
Thanks, guys. Great presentation. I mean, it's a marvelous undertaking to be able to characterize the entire basin, and particularly, you know, you've got it in phase one and what's outlined for phase two, assuming there's going to be some differences, you know, regionally between these different sub-basins. You know, I think it's one thing to be able to characterize how the system's working and then make some recommendations on how we may be able to improve that either via flow, via gravel, via channel improvements. But we start to run into some of the more complicated problems of either landowner willingness or some infrastructure implications when we want to, you know, add a large volume of gravel. And although ecologically it makes the most sense, geomorphically it makes the most sense, we've got infrastructure downstream that it might impact and could be a challenge on. But that being said, I think the need oftentimes outweighs what the possible impact would be enough to where the program could get off the ground and happen. But the first place to start anywhere is by doing the background study to document how things are working in the first place to justify the need, which is what you've laid the framework for here. So it's from what I've peeled into this, it's fantastic. For some of the projects I work on, I wish I had a background document like this that we could start from just from the very beginning rather than, you know, either so many programs are started without having this information and you just go out and think it's great, we're just going to chuck a bunch of wood in or we're going to pull some banks back without even really understanding the connectedness to different types of reaches upstream or downstream. So the bigger picture is extremely important. So I'm really encouraged to see where this goes, and it's going to be a great tool. Thanks.
Board Member Corbett.
Oh, I just wanted to ask you a question regarding mining gravel extraction, and how does that affect your restoration efforts? And at a really gross level, is too much being taken out, the right amount? Is there a surplus? Although I think I know the answer, but I wanted to hear from you.
Well, that's a good third rail for us to walk on. Certainly the Russian River was not suffering from too much gravel before, even though there was a very healthy supply. The fact that there was a lot of gravel in the river system meant that the, for example, the capacity of the low flow channel was relatively small, so that I think thinking about the Russian River or middle reach, you would have had water flowing out onto the floodplain, you know, every few years. And that meant the floodplain was more connected, that you had a better riparian habitat, shallow groundwater, so there was a, you know, good cool water for fish all the time. So that was sort of this idyllic situation ecologically. The work that was done to channelize the river and then removing the gravel had a purpose, and one purpose was to drain the floodplain better. And that benefited agriculture and provided this tremendous supply of aggregate. You know, much of the construction in the Bay Area was from Russian River gravel. I mean, I think the Golden Gate Bridge was largely built with Russian River gravel. So there were all these benefits, but the result is that we have a system that is in many ways deficient in gravel, and we still have this balance of the need to produce the gravel versus the impact. So if we were simply going to return the middle reach to the way it was with all the ecological benefits, we would have impacts on the ability to farm as is currently done and so on. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I'd say even without this idea of returning to the past situation, there are sort of some short-term impacts. You know, so we still have quite a bit of in-stream mining in Alexander Valley, and there probably would be some benefits to reducing that and allowing the gravel bars to build up again, and then some of the recovery of the channel bed elevation.
Mr. Norrie, Mr. Chair, can I just ask just to follow
up? Yes, sir.
My mic's back on. Just to follow up, Matt, Mr. St. John, do we have in, say, Sonoma County, up in Humboldt, we've got CHERT, the Humboldt Extraction Review Team that reviews gravel mining and talks about, you know, what sets extraction volumes for miners based on what they feel is sustainable for the sediment budgets. Is that similar entities existing down here and around other areas, or is that just unique to Humboldt County?
So I was looking in the audience to see if Stephen Bergston is in the room. He's not. The answer is I don't know.
The answer, I think, is actually that we have the Aggregate Resource Management Plan, which is the ARM plan, which was done in 1996, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was the kind of master EIR managing document for gravel extraction in Mainstown and within the county, too. It wasn't just Russian River, I believe. I believe it went further than that. That document's quite old. Mm-hmm. I believe also when there is also a project proposed, a gravel mining project, I believe it is subject to public review. And actually, Bob Leggy and Russian Riverkeeper may know way more than that because you have been active, I think, on some comments to that. But I think the ARM plan is kind of the Bible to that. And it is an older document.
Thank you.
Yeah. Board Member Giusti.
Mr. Chair, thank you both for the work. And then the way you presented it today, it was the 26-page executive summary was enough for me. I did read the whole thing, but that in itself was quite a document. What I really appreciated is how you've quantified what many of us have kind of known for a number of years, what's going on, and without coming out and saying it, that, you know, Coyote Dam is the root of many of the challenges that we face today. I appreciate that getting out. One of the question I have, though, is that most of the recommendations moving forward, most of the discussion moving forward, is working with the status quo, keeping Coyote Dam in place, recognizing that the impoundment is very, very important. The water that it holds and provides to this part of the reach is very important. But might it be possible to model a scenario where Lake Mendocino becomes an off-stream storage by creating some kind of channel, peripheral channel, if you will, that would allow the river to function closer to normal by making, you know, by removing the impediment. As an old farmer told me in 2014 when Lake Mendocino was nearly three-quarters drained, you know, there's so much sediment caught behind the dam, this old guy told me, great place to grow potatoes. You know, the alluvium out there has got to be 30 feet deep in some spots. But if there was some way to allow some of that natural functionality to be restored while holding the water, and is something like that even possible to model? and to get people thinking of not just working with the status quo, but taking engineering that was done in a different era using cars, you know, blocking streams, not putting fish ladders. Is there a way to modernize our thinking of how we can manage some of these systems, recognizing that the impoundment is important?
That idea came up maybe 10 years ago with the idea of a fish passageway around the lake. And the problem was that the steepness of the channel that they would have to build was too much to have the fish pass. Now, if you were just looking at sediment transport, you might be able to do something like that. Certainly, it would be a very big undertaking in terms of cost, because you'd have to grade mountains down to get around the lake. And I think that's why it hasn't gotten a lot of support after that initial proposal was sort of shown to not really function very well.
It is an interesting idea to think, are there other places offstream that we could develop that would be substitute for the storage that's now in the main stem and blocking the river? And yeah, there certainly must be a pretty good supply of gravel and, of course, fine sediment in there as well that could be fed back into the river. We allude to this, didn't really develop it in the report, but we've also talked about the idea of trying to restore the existing channel below Coyote Dam. And I visited a project in France this past summer where they took a stream that was deeply incised from gravel mining, and essentially they took the steep banks, they cut them, took that gravel and put it to fill up this incised channel, and they brought in another sort of 500,000 tons of gravel, I think, as well to augment. It was a big project, but they did recreate the historical kind of channel there with a very shallow water table, actively migrating channel, and a riparian zone that's developing. Something like that might be possible in that reach below Coyote Dam. It would be, you know, challenging right from the beginning because you have, private parcels. And in the case in France, there were much larger parcels and a lot of public land, so they didn't have that initial big hurdle. But I think it would be great just to go through an exercise of thinking outside the box. And what are all the possible ways that we might be able to re-engineer the system so that we still provide the water that's needed, but maybe there are ways that we could do it in some new way that would allow the system to recover in a fundamental way.
Because so many of these challenges that we face, whether it's Coyote Dam, whether it's the Van Arsdale diversion, as I said, you know, some of these are based on 19th century engineering technology. They're of a different era.
Yeah.
And we tend to want to just rely on those. And I think I totally agree. I think we need to force ourselves. Not going to be easy, but we need to force ourselves to think, well, how and what would we do in the 21st century to meet the same goals, but at the same time expand our ability to continue ecological functionality? But, you know, great report, great effort, and I hope this project stimulates that kind of conversation moving in the future, because I think that's what we need to do. Thank you very much for your work, both of you.
Thanks.
To tee off that a little bit, for one thing, I appreciate, for one, that this is a science review panel. This is not a political review panel, and you guys have been very careful, I think, to stay right in the middle of science, which is a great spot. I think this document is foundational in that it identifies the data gaps here. And Laurel, you read off the data gaps. You brought them up on screen. I'm a bit astonished by some of those data gaps. In reading that document, there's some fundamental stuff here that, and in fact, there's quite a lot that's not known here. And it's a little bit sobering, given that there are political decisions being made on the existing highly altered system that is highly out of balance in a lot of ways. I'm not so sure this is we need to think out of the box. I'm thinking it's more like a dodecahedron, because this thing has so many facets to it about where this thing is and where it could potentially go. The opportunity, I'm an opportunist, and the thing is that the way that I look at this is that, yeah, there's a dam. There's actually two dams in the middle of this darn thing and a big diversion above one of those dams. And Yet those dams, the reality and the political reality of those dams coming out are probably zero, I would have to guess, zero. And we have to sober up to that. But that doesn't mean that we couldn't use to manage those dams in a way that could be advantageous to the whole. At the same time, these salmonid species, and you mentioned some of the other species, and there's a ton of other species here. It happens to be that the salmonid species, I believe, are indicator species of the altered system, that because it's so altered and out of balance in places, that it no longer supports them, and so they are therefore listed. And yet, right now, just to be transparent, is that there's a fish flow EIR now to out to potentially crank these flows down based on a highly altered system. In a system that is way out of balance. And those decisions are big decisions here. At the same time, I look at Sigma. And Sigma, I like Sigma. I think the fact that we got to Sigma as a state of California is super important because we finally start to take steps towards groundwater. And in transparency, too, I have a well over in the Laguna at my house. And so I'm part of the problem as well. And there's like 50,000 of them in Sonoma County. And so I'm 1/50,000th of the problem. And I admit it. I swear. At the same time, though, you know, Sigma only really has, to this point, been looked at for high-priority groundwater basins in the state of California, of which we have, I think, zero.
No. It's medium and high. You have
medium,
to do the
medium
plans.
High. Yeah. Yellow, okay.
So Ukiah and Santa Rosa Plain are both considered medium.
Okay. I appreciate that. And at the same time, the management of groundwater here, I think, is very key in low-priority basins. If you look at these basins from the standpoint of some of the tributaries, Green Valley Creek comes to mind, the four tributaries that the State Board identified through their emergency orders, those are high-priority basins from the standpoint not of Sigma and the governance that is now in place in Sigma, but the places where potentially Sigma can be used as a tool out here. I believe we're dewatering these basins by consumptive use, and I think that's a fact. At the same time, going forward, my desire is then, it sounds like in a question, because this is all just commentary, my question is, can you elucidate and just kind of look a year, 5 years down the road of how you think sequential phases to this will go? This independent science review panel, I have to admit, when I look at the cast of characters that are here, are of high order, very high and well-respected professionals in their respective disciplines, and we're absolutely blessed to have them in place. And I hope that this then is the germ to remain together or to build upon that momentum to go forward. Can I ask you to then, if you had a magic crystal ball now, where would it go in 1 to 5 to 10 years and start to fill these data gaps or other things here?
Well, I think the first step would be to do a similar amount of work on the remaining sub-basins. So we left out a lot of things, like the whole lower river. We covered all of Mendocino County, and then we covered Alexander Valley, Mark West, Knights Valley, and Green Valley. So that leaves a lot of Sonoma County out of what was evaluated. And I think all of the panel members really wanted to kind of finish the job. So that, I think, might be one of their first steps. I don't know, maybe you have a good idea about this, how the panel exactly would fill the data gaps. They discussed quite a bit how having an academic presence with a lot of graduate students collecting data would get you a lot of information in a short period of time. And I think that's probably easier than maybe trying to gear up like a government agency to do it.
That's a great idea, actually.
But it all takes money, of course. And right now, finding money for monitoring is always a difficulty. You know, that's one of the categories of study that typically doesn't get funded. So we might have to work with state and local groups like yourselves to create a consortium agreeing, okay, these are the high priority data gaps. Here's who we want to have work on them, and here's how we're going to find the funding.
Well, one thing along that lines, is that there is a proposal for a regional monitoring plan here. It's, as I understand, mainly built right now around stormwater and municipal stormwater, but the regional monitoring plan could be potentially a vehicle to do that.
Okay.
and to start to move towards that. The other thing I would say is that two things is that, for one, that there's a lot of agencies involved here in this system and the management of this system, and that those agencies, we have experienced that the siloing of agencies, everybody's working independently here. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I didn't see, unless I missed it, is that the coordination of regulatory actions and vision.
Yeah, we didn't evaluate that.
That's okay. And maybe that was on purpose, and maybe it was a good idea. the thing is, but as it is now, though, the efforts here of the stakeholder community, which includes regulatory, includes landowners, water users, all the vested interests here and peripheral interests, need to be coordinated in a manner so that decision-making is not siloed, that it does look at the big picture, as you discussed, I believe. It's a very, very interesting report and body of work, and I very much appreciate that. By the way, the very last thing here is that we're the Water Quality Board, obviously, and the nexus also between this system and the altering of this system and the effects of water quality are certainly paramount for us as we take action. We've been an agency that has been trying to figure out how to work on some of this, and the agency, whether it be flow, whether it be ensizement, whether it be agricultural or municipal or domestic land use out here, it all also swings into our shop that way. And the nexus between water quantity, timing of water quantity, water quality is a very big equation here as well. So, all right, with that, I'll stop. Any other board member questions or comments? Fantastic. We have some speaker cards. I want to thank you again both for not only for the body work, but for coming here today.
No.
Thank you. Where do we stay here? Anybody else wants to speak? Speaker cards. I have one speaker card. Ms. Brenna Edelman.
Brenda Edelman, Russian River Watershed Protection Committee. I want to thank the board and the staff for having this presentation. I just read the 25-page summary and really have no background in this kind of study, but I just had this very strong feeling that this was very critically important information. And I would very much love to see this as I believe this report can set a vision for where we go with our policies around the Russian River, and that maybe tomorrow we're not going to fix everything, but I don't want to see it put on a shelf and forgotten. And I hope that won't happen, and that funds will be found for the needed monitoring and the extended work of this project. And I'm very impressed with Matt and Laurel and all of the scientists who took part in this. I too went to that meeting in Cloverdale, and I just walked out of there just feeling like this is where the future should go in caring for the river. And I just urge you to help make that happen. I've been spending a lot of time studying the issue with the low flow and the fact that the water agency is now considering approval of an EIR that basically is a manifestation of what the biological opinion asked for, which I'm sorry to say did not consider most of the things that are in this report. And I find a lot of problems with it. I have focused on the lower river portion mainly because I don't have the knowledge and capacity to look at the whole thing. But I've just found a lot of problems. And I'm very hopeful. I would like to suggest perhaps the state board would have a similar presentation. I know Mr. Moore is in the room. And I would hope that the state board, before they consider any kind of permanent lowering or changing of flows, will take this information into consideration, because I think it's critically important. I think there's a lot of things recommended in the biological opinion and the EIR and the Fish Flow Project that are just simply not based on critically important environmental information and the realities of what is needed to save the fish. I know for one thing they don't consider groundwater, they don't consider the tributaries. They separate the three, the upper river from the lower river and Dry Creek from both of those. There's just no integration in the whole plan, and there are just a lot of issues addressed. You know, one of the things I've discovered, I've been doing this work for 40 years, and one of the things I learned is that we're constantly trying to fix the mistakes of the generation before us, where people thought they were doing something that was okay and didn't really think about all the impacts, especially cumulative impacts. And then down the road, the people who are here and future generations then have to come back and fix what was broken before. And very often we're running out of solutions as we get further and further down that road. So I would hope that you continue to work with this document, that if you have a way of helping to get more monitoring information, I think we're always needing more information on our streams, whether it's directly for involving water quality or all the factors in the environment that contribute to water quality. It is extremely important, and I thank you for doing this, and I hope that we have not heard the end of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda. I don't have any other speaker cards. Oh, I do. Kimberly Burr is coming up. One thing I would be remiss if I didn't recognize the efforts out there and the studies that have been done that got mentioned, like the USGS studies, the investment that have gone into that. There is a great body of work that's been done contemporaneously that this actually is companion to, and that I believe that's ongoing, and I think that's the building of momentum here. Ms. Kimberly Burr.
Yeah, I don't really have any prepared remarks, just to say thank you to the board. I don't know whose idea this was. It was Matt or somebody's, but to bring this to you, I think, was I'm sorry, I'm Kimberly Burr. I've worked many years on restoring Green Valley Creek, and so does feel good to have people looking at Green Valley Creek, and I appreciate all the attention that it has gotten, and it still needs more help, and this is a fantastic study, and I am happy that it's based in the science world, because I think that's kind of important part of our development process, is getting the good science. So thank you very much for bringing this to us and all your work, Professor Condolf and Laurel and everybody. I just wanted to say that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. We have no other speaker cards. We'll close that item. Thank you very much for everybody that presented and the work that's ongoing. Appreciate it very much. We have a few other agenda items. Executive Officer report. You need a break?